Today, we're tackling something really critical, maybe one of the most stressful moments you can face. Figuring out when an asthma flare-up flips into a genuine, life-threatening emergency.
Yeah, it's that moment of panic, isn't it? When the breathing gets tight and you just want clarity. You need to know exactly when to worry, when to act.
Exactly. So our mission today is to dig into the medical sources. We want to build, essentially, a clear guide, a kind of checklist for when things get serious.
We need to define that line between a bad flare-up and a true medical crisis and understand the steps, including, you know, what actually happens treatment-wise if you end up in the hospital.
Right, because asthma can get very serious very fast. We need to nail down those red zone symptoms, the absolute warning signs that mean go now, protect your lungs, potentially save a life.
Okay, let's dive straight into that. Recognizing the emergency zone. The absolute core warning sign, the first thing to watch for, is when your quick relief inhaler thinks albuterol just isn't doing the job. It's not providing relief.
Okay, so the medicine isn't working. What's the first line protocol then? What do the guidelines say to try before you hit the panic button and call 911?
Well, the initial steps are quite specific. You use your rescue inhaler. The recommendation is 2 to 4 puffs. Then you wait 20 minutes.
Just 20 minutes.
Yes. And you can repeat that process up to 3 times, so for a full hour in total, you're giving the medication a real chance to kick in.
Okay, makes sense. But if after that hour, after those rounds of puffs...
If you're still seriously struggling to breathe after that hour, the decision's basically made for you. That's when you absolutely need to get to the ER.
And besides the inhaler just failing, there are physical signs too, right? Alarms the body sends out saying, this is serious. Things that mean call 911 or get emergency help immediately.
Oh, definitely. We're talking about signs of major distress, systemic failure almost. Like, can you actually speak if you can only get out a few words before you have to gasp for air?
That's a huge red flag.
A massive one. Then look at color. Any blue or gray tinge around the lips, on the face, even under the fingernails, that's cyanosis. It's a potential sign of oxygen deprivation, a very bad sign.
And how you feel mentally?
Crucial. Feeling lightheaded, dizzy, maybe confused, or suddenly breaking out in a cold sweat. That's your brain signaling it's not getting enough oxygen.
You might also see it physically, like someone really straining to breathe.
Exactly. Using neck muscles, seeing the chest pull in hard with each breath that's labored breathing, and of course, fainting or collapsing is an absolute emergency.
Okay, but you mentioned something before we started, something really counterintuitive from the sources. The silent chest.
Ah, yes. This is critical and honestly terrifying because it's so misleading. The silent chest. People might think, oh, the wheezing stopped. I must be getting better.
Less noise sounds like good news, like the attack is easing off. But the sources warn this is actually the worst sign. That feels completely backward.
It does, but it's vital to understand. That silence means the airways are now so swollen, so constricted, that air literally cannot move through them enough to even make the wheezing sound.
Wow. So the sound stops because almost no air is moving.
Precisely. It signals impending respiratory failure. If the wheezing suddenly vanishes during a severe attack, that's not relief. That is a code red emergency. Get help immediately. The silence is the danger signal.
Okay, that's a chillingly important point. Now, to bring some objectivity into this, beyond just feelings or sounds, the sources mentioned the peak flow meter. This seems like a key decision-making tool.
It absolutely is. Think of your peak flow reading as your objective data point. It cuts through the panic or maybe the tendency to downplay things.
So how does it work in practice?
You need to know your personal best peak flow number, what's normal for you when you're well. Let's say your best is 400. If you measure during an attack, and the reading is under 50% of that.
So under 200 in this example.
Correct. If it's under 50%, that number basically overrides everything else. Even if you just took your rescue inhaler, even if you think you might be feeling slightly better, under 50% means go to the hospital. Now, trust the number.
And there's a reason for this speed, isn't there? Something about the treatment window.
Yes. A 2019 study highlighted this. The first hour of a severe exacerbation is the golden hour, the optimal time for treatment to be most effective. Acting fast can genuinely save lung function. Delay is risky.
Okay, so we've identified the emergency signs, but there's another potential point of confusion. Sometimes breathing problems aren't asthma, even if they look similar. Let's unpack asthma versus anaphylaxis.
Right, this is a really important distinction because the immediate treatment is different. They can both present with wheezing and chest tightness, which is confusing.
So how do you tell them apart in that critical moment?
Onset is a key clue. Asthma often builds up a bit more gradually, maybe triggered by things like cold air, getting a cold, exercise, or pollen exposure.
And anaphylaxis.
Anaphylaxis is typically rapid and severe. It's a full-body allergic reaction, usually following a very specific, sudden trigger like eating a certain food, an insect sting, maybe latex exposure.
And visually, are there signs for anaphylaxis?
Yes, and this is crucial. Anaphylaxis often comes with distinct visual cues you usually don't see with asthma alone. Things like hives, an itchy skin rash, or significant swelling, especially of the lips, tongue, or throat. That swelling is called angioedema.
Okay, hives, swelling, those are key differentiators. But what if someone has, say, allergic asthma? Things could overlap, couldn't they? If you're wheezing and you get a rash, what's the protocol? Why prioritize anaphylaxis treatment?
It comes down to speed and severity. Anaphylaxis can cause circulatory collapse much faster than most asthma attacks progress. So the guidance is clear. If there's any doubt at all, especially if you see that rash or swelling alongside the breathing issues, you treat for anaphylaxis first.
Meaning grab the epinephrine auto-injector.
Yes. Use the EpiPen or equivalent immediately. Epinephrine works systemically to counter the reaction while you're getting emergency help. It buys critical time. Treat the potentially faster killer first.
Makes sense. Okay, so we know the red zone, but not every single flare-up warrants a trip to the ER, right? Let's talk about the levels below that, the triage options for when things are concerning, but maybe not quite life or death yet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a spectrum. Let's start with your regular doctor, your primary care physician.
When is that the right call?
This is really for your baseline management or mild kind of steady symptoms that have been going on for a few days. Maybe you're coughing a bit more, feeling a little tighter than usual, but it's not escalating rapidly.
So it's more about long-term control.
Exactly. It's the place to adjust your daily controller medications, discuss ongoing triggers, like maybe it's the cold air season, or you suspect mold or get referrals for allergy testing. It's proactive, not reactive care for the most part.
Okay, level up from that. Urgent care. When does that fit in?
Urgent care is for that middle ground. Your asthma isn't getting better with your home rescue plan. You're definitely symptomatic, but you're not in immediate severe danger. You can still walk, talk in full sentences.
And the peak flow meter, where would that likely be?
Typically in the yellow zone, somewhere between 50% and 80% of your personal best. You need more than your rescue inhaler, perhaps a nebulizer treatment, or even oral steroids, which urgent care can often provide.
But there's a really important caveat here, isn't there, about the limits of urgent care?
Yes, absolutely crucial. Urgent care centers are not equipped for severe life-threatening asthma attacks. They can't handle something like status asthmaticus that's a severe, prolonged attack that isn't responding to the initial treatment.
So if things are getting worse fast, or if you were already in that under 50% red zone?
You skip urgent care entirely. Go straight to the ER. They have the resources, respiratory therapists, ICU backup if needed. Knowing the capability difference is key.
Got it. And the third option, which has become much more common, telehealth or doctor on demand.
Right. Telehealth can be a great option for mild symptoms. Maybe you're just coughing more, feeling a bit off with your asthma, but you're not actually short of breath or in distress.
Useful for maybe getting advice or tweaking meds.
Exactly. Good for prescription refills for your controller meds, maybe a quick discussion about adjusting doses or talking through recent triggers like, did the pollen count spike? Did you visit a friend with a cat?
But you need to be ready for that call, don't you?
Definitely. If you use telehealth for asthma, you need to come prepared. Have your recent peak flow readings handy, know your exact medication list, and have notes on potential triggers. The doctor needs that concrete info to help you remotely.
Okay, that makes sense. Preparation is key there. Now, let's shift to planning before the crisis hits. The sources emphasize having tools ready. Two key things: an emergency action plan and an immediate technique.
Yes, being prepared is half the battle. The foundation is the formal asthma emergency plan. This isn't just a vague idea. It should be a personalized, written document you create with your doctor.
Takes the guesswork out when you're stressed or struggling to breathe.
Precisely. It's your roadmap, and it's really important to think of it as a living document. It needs to be reviewed regularly and definitely updated after any significant flare-up or ER visit.
And the core of this plan is often that traffic light system, right? Green, yellow, red.
That's the most common format, yeah. Green zone is go, means you're feeling good, just take your daily controller meds as usual. Yellow zone is caution. Mild symptoms are starting, like coughing or slight wheezing. The plan tells you exactly which extra meds to take, like your rescue inhaler, and when to call the doctor.
And a red.
Red zone is danger. It lists those specific severe symptoms we talked about, difficulty speaking, low peak flow numbers, etc. And the instruction is clear. Use your rescue meds as prescribed and go to the ER or call 911.
What else should be in our plan?
It needs to be comprehensive. List all your daily and rescue medications with dosages, your known specific triggers, those step-by-step rescue actions for each zone, the clear danger signs, and all your emergency contact numbers. If it's for a child, copies need to be at school, with caregivers, everywhere.
Okay, that's the strategic plan. But what about the immediate first aid moment when an attack suddenly hits hard? There's a simple rule for that, isn't there? The 444 rule.
Yes, the 444 rule. Think of this as your immediate action sequence, the what to do right now protocol, before you even have time to consult the full plan.
So how does it work?
It's straightforward. Step one, take four separate puffs of your quick relief inhaler. Using a spacer is always recommended. If you have one, it helps the medicine get into the lungs better.
Okay, four puffs, then.
Step two, wait 4 minutes. See if your breathing starts to improve.
And if it doesn't, after 4 minutes, still struggling.
Step three, take four more puffs of the rescue inhaler.
All right, another four puffs. What happens next is critical.
Yes. The final step, and one people sometimes forget in the panic. After that second set of four puffs, wait another 4 minutes. If you're still not feeling significant improvement,
call for help.
Call emergency services 911 or your local equivalent immediately. But while you're waiting for help to arrive, you can continue taking four puffs every 4 minutes up to a maximum of 20 puffs within an hour, as long as you need it.
So it's about getting medication in quickly while simultaneously escalating to the highest level of care without delay.
Exactly. Quick action, measured response, and prompt call for backup if needed.
Okay, this is really practical. Now, let's move into the hospital setting. If you do end up in the ER, what actually happens? What did the clinical teams do to get your breathing under control? The sources detail a pretty specific protocol.
They do. Once you're in the ER for a severe asthma attack, the approach is aggressive and focused on stabilizing you quickly. They want to open the airways, reduce the swelling, and get your oxygen levels up.
What's usually the very first step?
Almost always. It starts with giving you supplemental oxygen, usually through a nasal cannula or mask. Then comes medication, typically starting with nebulized albuterol.
So that's the mist machine, not the puffer.
Correct. A nebulizer delivers a continuous flow of medicated mist, which can be easier to inhale deeply when you're struggling. And often, they'll combine the albuterol with another drug called ipratropium.
Ipratropium? That sounds technical. Why add that? What does it do that albuterol doesn't?
Good question. Ipratropium is what's called an anticholinergic. Albuterol works by relaxing certain muscles in the airways, beta agonist. Ipratropium works on a different set of receptors and muscles. Using both together gives a kind of 1-2 punch.
Attacking the problem from two angles simultaneously.
Exactly. It provides a stronger, more comprehensive bronchodilation opening of the airways than albuterol alone for many people in a severe attack.
Okay, so that tackles the immediate airway tightness. But what about the underlying inflammation, the swelling that's causing the problem?
They need to address that quickly, too. That's where steroids come in. They'll usually give you corticosteroids, like methylprednisolone, intravenously through an IV line.
High IV steroids work faster than pills.
Much faster to get into your system and start reducing that airway inflammation. If things still aren't improving sufficiently with the oxygen nebulizer treatments and IV steroids, they might add magnesium sulfate.
Magnesium? I thought that was a mineral.
It is. But given intravenously, magnesium sulfate can also help relax the bronchial smooth muscles, providing additional airway opening. And one more thing they often do is give IV fluids.
For hydration?
Yes, because when you're breathing that rapidly, you lose a lot of moisture, leading to dehydration, which can actually make secretions thicker and breathing harder. So IV fluids help with overall stability.
What happens in the really, really severe cases, the ones that don't respond even to all of that?
In those extreme situations, like true status asthmaticus, or sometimes what's called brittle asthma, where attacks are sudden and severe, if the patient isn't responding and is tiring out, or oxygen levels are dropping dangerously,
they might need breathing support.
Yes. Doctors may need to perform intubation, placing a breathing tube into the windpipe and connect the patient to a ventilator, a breathing machine. This takes over the work of breathing, ensures oxygen delivery, and allows the potent IV medications time to work and the lungs to recover.
That sounds intense, and they're monitoring constantly.
Absolutely. Continuous oxygen saturation monitoring, checking arterial blood gases to see the actual levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the blood, and repeated peak flow measurements to track the response to treatment. It's very closely managed.
So just to circle back on a common question, The ER will almost always give albuterol first, usually nebulized.
Yes, that's generally the cornerstone of initial ER treatment for an acute asthma exacerbation.
This has been incredibly detailed, a really structured walkthrough of a scary situation. So let's try to summarize the key takeaways for you, the listener.
Okay, I'd say first, trust your gut. If something feels really wrong, severely different from your usual flares, pay attention. But don't rely only on feelings.
Right. Use that peak flow meter. Know your number. Let under 50% be your non-negotiable trigger to go to the ER.
Absolutely. And remember, that terrifying silent chest warning wheezing that suddenly stops is an emergency, not a relief.
Know the difference between the immediate first aid, that 444 rule, and your comprehensive long-term asthma action plan with its traffic light zones. They work together.
And connecting all this emergency knowledge back to the bigger picture, it's all about prevention eventually, isn't it? The goal is always to avoid getting into that red zone in the first place.
Which means understanding and managing your triggers.
Exactly. And the list is broad, as the sources remind us. Common culprits include respiratory infections. Colds and flu are huge triggers. Allergens are big, too. Pollen, dust mites, pet dander, mold, even cockroach droppings in some environments.
Then there are irritants.
Smoke is a major one. Tobacco smoke, wood smoke, strong odors, air pollution. Even breathing in cold, dry air can trigger asthma for many people. Workplace irritants, too.
And surprisingly, maybe intense emotions.
Yes, seems unfair. But strong emotions, laughing hard, crying, significant stress or anxiety can actually trigger asthma symptoms. It's likely linked to changes in breathing patterns during those emotional states.
Understanding that whole landscape of personal triggers allows you to shift focus, right? From just reacting to crises to proactively managing this day-to-day. Turning it into a manageable chronic condition.
That's the ultimate goal. Good control means fewer emergencies.
So, here's a final thought to leave you with. We talked about the asthma action plan being a living document. The real challenge, maybe, isn't just knowing the emergency steps during the crisis itself. It's the discipline after a severe event.
You mean going back and updating the plan?
Exactly. Proactively sitting down with your doctor and asking, what did we learn from this last bad attack? Was there a new trigger we didn't realize? Did the medication response tell us something? What specific change needs to be written into my plan now so we're better prepared next time?
That reflection and proactive updating, that's crucial for long-term safety and control.
That ongoing discipline might be the most important step of all. Something to think about.